spite of deep and sometimes irresolvable differences, we can and must live together peaceably. That's the view of First Amendment scholar and distinguished professor of law and religion, John Inazu.
What is the unity that holds us together? What's the content of the people in terms of giving us a shared story? And that's a contingent question. It's a question that we have to keep answering, and we have to have a credible story to tell ourselves about it.
Dr. John Inazu is author of Confident Pluralism, Surviving and Thriving Through Deep Difference. And that was the topic of his talk earlier this year on the campus of Eastern Kentucky University as part of the Chautauqua Lecture Series. Dr. Inazu is our guest for this special edition of Eastern Standard. We're not live this week, but we're still glad to hear from you at any time. Write to us at wekueasternstandard@gmail.com, send a tweet at wekuest, or call 859-622-1657. It's time for Eastern Standard, right after the latest news from NPR. From the studios of WEKU on the campus of Eastern Kentucky University, this is Eastern Standard. Hello, I'm John Hingsbergen. This week, a special recorded edition of our show featuring a recent guest to the EKU campus, the final speaker in the 2016-17 Chautauqua Lecture Series, the series featuring the theme Order and Chaos. Dr. John Inazu is a well-known First Amendment scholar, the Sally D. Danforth Distinguished Professor of Law and Religion at Washington University, the author of Confident Pluralism and Liberty's Refuge, and a columnist for USA Today, CNN, The Hedgehog Review, The Los Angeles Times, and The Washington Post. Dr. Inazu joins us while on campus to deliver his talk, which served as the keynote address for EKU's celebration of First Amendment Week. Welcome, Dr. Inazu.
John, it's great to be here. Thanks for having me.
Order and Chaos, the theme of the Chautauqua Lecture Series for 2016-2017. And your topic, Confident Pluralism, Surviving and Thriving Through Deep Difference. As an attorney, a political scientist, an author, talk about your definition of pluralism and where that comes into play, especially in this time in history.
I think we want to think of pluralism in two different ways. And the first way is as a description of our current reality, that we have a society where people hold deep and incommensurable differences about a lot of things that matter. And we're not going to resolve those differences. So the question is, how do we live with those differences? And that brings me to the second definition of pluralism, as I understand it, which is a political response that lets us choose coexistence in spite of our differences rather than the alternatives of total control where we suppress difference or chaos where we let difference reign to our detriment. So this is the idea that without papering over or moving for feigned agreement, we actually recognize the depths of our differences and then figure out ways legally and culturally to live with those.
Is this issue of pluralism the same in other nations, other parts of the world as here in the U.S.? I mean, I know our society was founded as a pluralistic society, people coming together from a variety of places, and the original natives and original inhabitants of this part of the world, of North America, were essentially eradicated. But does this come up as an issue in Europe or in Africa or in Asian countries?
I think the political challenge of pluralism is going to be present in all parts of the world, and it's going to be a factor of who is in the mix politically. So pluralism is not as hard of a project in a place like Sweden. It's harder when you have immigration patterns and different racial groups and different ideological beliefs that start to clash in confined spaces. And so it is a growing challenge in Europe and here as well. One of the things that makes the pluralism experiment in the United States distinctive is our constitutional history and our attention to the First Amendment, which both helps and hinders in some ways the pluralist experiments here.
Is there something about our current time that causes us to focus on the existence of or non-existence of a pluralistic worldview or view of our society? I mean, this nation has been here 200 and some years. Is there something that has shifted in the recent years that caused us to re-examine the concept of pluralism?
Well, I think it depends on who you ask and where that person's starting position is. So in some ways, we have seen a kind of fracturing. In one way, there had been a a kind of cultural and ethical consensus in the white middle class that was kind of a Protestant consensus of sorts, and that has diminished in recent years, and with a growing attention to a diversity of viewpoints and ideas along gender, race, and other norms, there's pressure on what had been an assumed consensus around different beliefs. So in that way, things have changed. In another sense, we're having the challenges around discourse and how we relate to one another that have been there throughout our country's history. When we look back at the election of 1800, for example, the political diatribe was very intense, and we fought a civil war later in our country's history. And so the idea that we have trouble getting along, that we lose sight of our civic aspirations and practices, and that we use the law against one another, that's something that has been with us for a long time.
How does the very large size of the United States affect one's view of pluralism? Again, I would imagine pluralism in Los Angeles or in Chicago or in New York or even Miami Beach would be very different than pluralism in Corbin, Kentucky.
Sure. There's a deep political question in the background, which is the extent to which an experiment in pluralism as a political matter can survive as the size of the polity increases. So when the founders and Madison are talking about pluralism, they have a distinctive geography in mind that in some ways facilitates the possibility of a shared political experiment. We might be past that point in terms of just our raw size right now and the scope of our country. And then to your point, all of that seems to be exacerbated by where people choose to live. So the sense of polarization, the sense of isolation, the sense of echo chambers comes to pass differently in different parts of the country. Los Angeles is quite different than Central Kentucky in terms of the kinds of questions and really the kinds of issues that people are identifying.
Let's talk a little bit about some of the issues that have risen to the surface in recent years. Even though this has been a pluralistic nation, people from European nations to a great extent settled here, but now we have persons of a variety of racial backgrounds and ethnic backgrounds and wide diversity of languages spoken in our cities. And everywhere we go, we are confronted with the fact that what we might consider the traditional white middle class society is no longer the only society to be taken into consideration. Instructions on census forms are printed in a variety of languages. Packaging, advertising includes a variety in approaches and cultural approaches and languages. I mean, how has just the very change in the makeup of our population affected pluralism in this country?
I think it's a mixed story. I mean, in some ways, we can see lots of gains that come from a greater realization of a diverse population. And in some ways, this isn't really a new thing in terms of who's actually here. It's just a greater attention to some of the voices that were not getting a hearing in an earlier era. We've always had racial minorities. We've always had differences across gender. We've had religious differences. And sometimes in the past, when power politics has suppressed those voices, we actually just haven't recognized the full extent of our differences. But once we do so, there are always challenges to what is the unity that holds us together? What's the content of the people in terms of giving us a shared story? And that's a contingent question. It's a question that we have to keep answering, and we have to have a credible story to tell ourselves about it.
I mean, the basis of our nation and the origins of our shared story really go back to the founding documents such as the Constitution. Do you believe the framers of the Constitution had in mind the kind of pluralism that we experience today?
Well, I'm not clear that the framers could have envisioned the reality of what we have today, but they did have a sense in which they understood the costs and the opportunities of deep differences. And so we look back then and we think, well, gee, these were basically a bunch of white Protestants trying to figure out how to live together. How hard could that be? But in the day, that was extremely hard, right? In other places of the world, they were killing each other over these differences. The mere fact that the founders and the people who started this political project could figure out ways to live together across religious and political differences, even when they really didn't like each other, is a model of sorts, but it's one that's become much more complicated. And I think when we look back on our history and look at its best moments, we see this possibility of pluralism played out. And in its worst moments, we see fear and suppression when we realize new differences in our midst.
Let's talk a little bit about politics. We are less than a year away from a very divisive election and the process of election in this country, with what many people would consider surprising results of the election of Donald Trump as president. And oftentimes, after a presidential election, the country tends to come together, at least for a brief period of time, and we tend to see some form of unification. Am I correct in assuming that that has not occurred after this most recent election, and perhaps even the division and separation has grown even wider?
It sure seems to be the case, and in some ways this has not been a normal election or post-election season in any sense, and there are lots of factors contributing to that, including the views that a lot of people have about our current president. But I think that the situation seems to be fueled by a growing sense of enormous stakes on both sides, with a decreasing willingness to see charitably the possibilities in either side. And so we saw this actually in the buildup to the general election, where both major parties were becoming increasingly Puritan-esque in the kinds of beliefs that they were asking their members to hold. We saw this in the Women's March after the inauguration, where it became its own sort of ideologically pure effort. And there is less of a creative sense of partnership together across difference and more of a sense of you're either with us or you're against us.
This is Eastern Standard on the WEKU stations. Dr. John Inazu, our guest for this week's special recorded edition of the program. Dr. Inazu was the final speaker in the 2016-17 Chautauqua Lecture Series, the series featuring the theme Order and Chaos. Dr. Inazu, a well-known First Amendment scholar, Sally D. Danforth Distinguished Professor of Law and Religion at Washington University, the author of Confident Pluralism and Liberty's Refuge, a columnist for USA Today, CNN, The Hedgehog Review, The Los Angeles Times, and The Washington Post. And we'll get back to Dr. Inazu in just a few minutes. This program is an interactive show, and even though today's program is not live, we're glad to hear from you. Please feel free to write to us at any time, WEKU Eastern Standard at gmail.com, send a tweet at WEKU EST, or call and leave a voicemail message on the listener comment line, 859-622-1657. You can do that at any time of the day or night, 859-622-1657, or send that email to WEKU Eastern Standard at gmail.com. We're interested in your comments about shows you've heard, your suggestions for future topics or shows. When you write to us, WEKU Eastern Standard at gmail.com, or call 859-622-1657. More with Dr. John Inazu in just a few moments. This is Eastern Standard on the WEKU stations. I'm John Hingsbergen, and this week, a special edition of our program, we have with us in the studio Dr. John Inazu, who is speaking as part of the Chautauqua Lecture Series, the 2016-2017 series, the final speaker in this year's series, and giving the keynote address for First Amendment Week. It's an event happening on campus sponsored by the Department of Communication, the Department of Government and Economics, the African American Studies Program, and the Honors Program at Eastern Kentucky University. And Dr. Inazu, we were speaking briefly about the 2016 presidential election. Your topic on campus when you spoke, and we're speaking in past tense because this program will air some weeks following your visit to campus, but your topic, Confident Pluralism, Surviving and Thriving Through Deep Difference. Nothing defines that deep difference, I guess, in American society as did the 2016 election? Or would you say that there have been times when we are more divided than we were and perhaps still are?
Well, certainly historically, there have been greater times of division. The Civil War is probably the paradigmatic example. And we have divisions currently in our country that were related to but somewhat distinct from the presidential election, the ongoing discussion about challenges between law enforcement and racial minority communities, challenges about sexuality, challenges about religious freedom. These kinds of questions are with us sort of independent of the election. But you're right that the rhetoric and visibility of the past election season highlighted our political divisions in ways we haven't seen in a long time. And I think it took a lot of people by surprise the extent of the animosity and the extent of the othering of people of different political persuasions.
What would you say are the roots of that reaction that brought about the circumstances of the 2016 election? I mean, the fact that it's kind of shocking in many ways that 8 years previously we had elected the first person of color of any diversity beyond a white person in this country as president of the United States. A lot of rejoicing, a lot of reacting positively to that election. Was this past election a reaction to that major shift?
You know, I've heard people talk some about a reaction in this election season, and I'm not an expert in this particular area. I don't have a strong sense that that explains much of it. I think more of the fact that neither of the major political parties was able to cast any kind of a vision that spoke to the country as a whole. We had the campaign slogans. We had Make America Great Again and Stronger Together. But in both cases, I think people who weren't immediately in the ideological sweet spot of those messages were wondering, where do I fit in this picture? When Trump says Make America Great Again, is he talking about me? Is he talking about the people and the things I care about? And when Clinton says Stronger Together, who is the us that makes us together? And in both cases, it seemed like time and time again, we had a failure of imagination to reach out beyond the envisioned demographics to something broader. And that's where I think a lot of people on both sides felt completely left out of the process.
What do you see as the major issues that affect pluralism in our society going forward at this point? You mentioned challenges to religious liberty, tensions within the law enforcement and minority communities, LGBTQ rights.
Yeah, certainly all of those. The other one that comes to mind, we're going to have continuing challenges with immigration in lots of ways. That's going to bring religious challenges. That's going to bring systemic and structural challenges and lots of policy questions around immigration. I think the one of the biggest issues might be the challenge of class and how we actually haven't figured out a good way to think through the differences in class. And so even in the best examples of pluralism in this country, when you think of the big cities that bring people together across religious and racial and other divides, they're still pretty class segmented. And there is a sense in which the elite classes of this country, especially in both major political parties, do not have a sense of people who are not like them, particularly along class dimensions.
I mean, when we talk about people who are not like us, is the correct approach to that the fact that we will tolerate the differences between us, or should we be embracing, affirming the differences among the peoples of our country? Should we be running from pluralism or trying to find a way to, sorry, trying to think out loud here. You know, are we better off accepting the fact that pluralism exists, embracing it, or would we be better off to work toward what we used to call the melting pot, where we all kind of become similar to one another with some minor differences?
And I think the answer to that question depends on what we're talking about. And I probably shouldn't say this on this program, but I'll out myself as a Duke basketball fan. And I think in some ways it's okay that I like Duke and plenty of people listening to this show like another team, and that makes it more fun for all of us. But we have we have very serious differences about other issues where we actually don't think that the difference is okay. I might believe very passionately in something about which you disagree with me, and the end game is not just to affirm completely all of our differences. It is to say we live in some kind of a sense of tragedy that we don't agree on some very important matters, and we work toward mutual persuasion. So in that sense, tolerance is not ultimate acceptance. It's a willingness to endure with one another across our differences. And that means that some differences are not just intrinsically good, but they're actually a challenge that we have to figure out how to live with.
What is your presumption when you approach speaking to an audience of college students on a campus in central Kentucky? What are you presuming about the community of listeners, students, faculty, and other members of the community? Do you assume because of the region you're visiting that there's a certain mindset? Do you assume because it's a university campus that the audience kind of rises above the geographic and norm that one would expect? And, you know, is the talk that you would give here different than one you would give in Chicago or in Seattle?
Yeah, it's such a great question. Let me respond in two ways. One, when I think about the age demographic, particularly of college students, there are similarities there regardless of the region of the country and some of the challenges and the opportunities. So the opportunities include a greater willingness, I think, to imagine possibilities of relationships across difference, a better understanding of growing up in what's really a global political economy and having a sense of that. The challenges are, first and foremost, the presence and role of social media in structuring relationships, and increasingly the challenge of encouraging students to find ways to engage face-to-face. And then I would say, in terms of this audience in this location, without having seen them, my presumption is going to be that just based on the demographics, some of the challenges along racial lines will be harder here to think about and talk about than in a place like Chicago or Los Angeles. And that means that the discussion, the national discussion that on an ongoing level about questions of race and issues, political issues related to race, it means that the questions we ask and the tone of the conversation might be different here than somewhere else. And I think that's one of the biggest hurdles to a national conversation is we forget the regional differences that we have to account for in the first kinds of questions we ask.
Our society today, because of media and technology and our continual interconnectedness through the mobile devices that we carry with us, one would think that because of what we have available today and our ability to interact around the planet, that diversity would be the norm. That when we watch media, watch movies or TV, we're constantly seeing diversity of race and viewpoints, political as well as social and other demographic differences. What role have media played in bringing about what you would consider a more healthy approach to pluralism, or has media made it worse?
I worry that the answer is mostly in the negative here, that most of the trends we've seen, especially in the online spaces with media, have made things worse. And that's tied to a couple of background challenges. One, I think, is the challenge of the weakening of authority and institutions across a variety of sectors. The media is one of them, but we could also talk about higher education or government or religion. And the collective weakening of institutions puts pressure on the nature of authority. So it used to be, back in the day, we would sit down and listen to one of the three major network anchors or a couple of key magazines or national newspapers. And those constrained authorities brought their own sets of challenges, but they were at least a set of common authorities around which we could have a conversation. And today, it seems that the fracturing of particularly news authorities into a siloed effect where we can select and choose our news feeds and sources means that we are individually and sometimes collectively perceiving actual events quite differently depending on the perspectives of the news that we're hearing. And that can lead to radically different understandings of the state of the world, which makes it very difficult to communicate with one another.
To what extent is our current situation a matter of
generational differences, the differences between millennials, Gen Y and Gen Xers, or baby boomers, or other segments of our society. I mean, obviously, we're living in a very different world than when the baby boomers were ruling and they were the focus of our culture.
So I'm a member of Generation X, and I'm increasingly wondering whether my generation, which a lot of people tend not to talk about, is a kind of translation generation that can help. I think many people my age, when I talk about these kinds of issues, say we see a lot of strengths and benefits to boomers in terms of, you know, speaking quite generally, how they view the world and things that they're thinking about. And we see a lot of strengths and possibilities in the millennials. And we see the two generations, at least kind of in national discussions, talking past each other or not appreciating it. So I do wonder if there's a way in which that conversation can be stronger. I do think the technological differences matter here, and an understanding of how media works and how influence works is a major divide now, generally speaking, between a boomer generation and a millennial generation, where people get their news sources, what counts as the nature of authority. It's just seen quite differently by those two generations.
Let's speak about some of the specifics of the areas where we have some differences of opinion over a variety of issues. I mean, let's talk about religious liberty, for instance. So one of the reasons for the founding of this nation, people coming to this continent to seek religious liberty. Why is that even a discussion or an issue today?
It does not cease to amaze me whenever I speak on this topic. Inevitably, one of the questions that comes up toward the end of the Q&A is something along the lines of, I am excited about and can get behind this vision of pluralism, but what about the Muslims? What happens when Sharia law comes to our area of the country? And I hear this around the country, regardless of sort of the setting that I'm speaking in. And there is this sense, and I'm not quite sure where some of it comes from, but this apprehension and suspicion of Islam, and to the extent that it will integrate into the American experiment. And my answer is usually, this is a contingent political question. We do not yet know the answer as to whether Islam will be Americanized enough to live sort of peaceably here in this country. But this is the same kind of question that in earlier generations we asked about Catholics and Jews and Mormons, and there was suspicion and there was distrust and there was concern about allegiances to foreign powers. And we muddled through it, and we look back on those times. And when those times led to the suppression of religious liberty, I think most people look back with some sense of shame. And so in the current moment, it is just essential to think about the significance of religious liberty for everyone, including American Muslims. And to the extent that people in this country are advocating for religious liberty in a partial or incomplete sense, that argument becomes extremely self-serving and ultimately not very persuadable.
I mean, in your view, was the issue of Islam and its ability to be part of American society, was that even an issue prior to 9/11, prior to the war on terror, prior to the whole movement that tended to focus on those who were practitioners of Islam?
I think there was undoubtedly a shift after 9/11. I was working at the Pentagon on that day, and I remember the immediate days and weeks in the aftermath, and there was this collective national attention in ways that we hadn't seen before to the challenge of Islam. And I don't at all mean to dismiss those challenges. They're quite real in some segments of Islam. But just like any challenge of an incoming belief or ideology or religious persuasion, there are going to be complicated differences and complicated people, and those are the things that we need to pay attention to. There is an ongoing geopolitical challenge around some versions of Islam, and that's very important, and we can't discount that. At the same time, there are tremendous urgent needs around refugee populations and other people coming here or who are here already, and those are real people whose immediate basic political needs have to be addressed.
And we talk about refugee populations, but what about issues within the populations that have been on this continent for many years? So we talk about in the last number of years, there have been numerous clashes between law enforcement and minority communities, and issues that have arisen over police shootings of minorities in a variety of circumstances. What's going on there? Again, after all the efforts of the post-Civil War era and the civil rights movement that occurred in the mid-20th century, and a belief that our society was progressing in terms of race relations, from your point of view, what occurred to bring racial tensions back to the forefront?
Well, I think they've, depending on where you start asking the questions, they've always been there. I think they had sort of fallen out of the consciousness of a number of white Americans. But if you went to an African-American community and asked whether racial relations in this country were going well 5 years ago or 10 years ago or 20 years ago, I think generally speaking, you would hear no, and for a variety of complicated reasons. And here, one of my real frustrations, and maybe a frustration that could turn into a hope, is that the current debate around race and the challenges of race is so ideologically polarized. And I think that the solutions actually fall in neither direction. In other words, I think the kinds of challenges structurally and otherwise that we are confronting around question of race are going to require creative and imaginative partnerships across partisan lines that are going to have to account for a variety of causes and potential solutions. And people do not seem to be talking about those, particularly on the national level. But the structural, we can't underestimate the significance of the civil rights era. It was massively important, and it also left a great deal undone. And when we look at neighborhoods, healthcare inequities, school inequities today in many of the major cities of our country, the challenges are absolutely enormous.
This is Eastern Standard on the WEKU stations. Our guest on today's special edition of the program, Dr. John Inazu, speaking as part of the Chautauqua Lecture Series on campus at Eastern Kentucky University, Confident Pluralism, Surviving and Thriving Through Deep Difference. We'll continue our conversation in just a moment. This is Eastern Standard on the WEKU stations. Hello, I'm John Hingsbergen. And with me on this special edition of our program, Dr. John Inazu. He is the author of Confident Pluralism, Surviving and Thriving Through Deep Difference, also the author of Liberty's Refuge, The Forgotten Freedom of Assembly. Dr. Inazu is a Sally D. Danforth Distinguished Professor of Law and Religion at Washington University and a senior fellow for the Institute for Advanced Studies and Culture, University of Virginia, and came to the campus of Eastern Kentucky University at the end of April to give the keynote address for First Amendment Week as part of the Chautauqua Lecture Series, the topic Confident Pluralism. Dr. Inazu, talking about some of the issues that challenge pluralism, or maybe they shine a light on the pluralism of our nation. We talked a little bit about religious liberty and the issues of law enforcement and minority communities. This issue of LGBTQ rights that has come up over the last number of years. We're just approaching the second anniversary of the Supreme Court decision that legalized same-sex marriage in our country. Meanwhile, there's a lot of discussion about whether same-sex marriage should be legal in our country after that decision of just 2 years ago, and a lot of folks who think that perhaps the current presidential administration and the current effort to appoint judges, and if there are more opportunities to appoint judges to the Supreme Court, there will be reversal of that issue, as well as perhaps Roe versus Wade on abortion. How do you see that fitting into the picture? Like so many other things, it seems like, okay, the society's moving one direction. We're headed here. We're headed here. We're acknowledging and accepting diversity. And then all of a sudden, kind of a yank back that, no, maybe we're not really going there. Or maybe, you know, some folks who didn't want to go there hadn't been heard, and now they need to be heard.
Yeah, I think it might be important to disentangle abortion and LGBTQ rights, particularly at the Supreme Court level. My sense about, from what I've seen in polling data and discussions nationally, is abortion is in some ways a more contested issue now than it has been. And so depending on one's position, you could talk about going back or going forward. But there seems to be more debate, more concern or confusion across different divides. We even saw this week within the Democratic Party, Bernie Sanders pushing back on a kind of absolutism about reproductive rights from the Democratic DNC chair. And so I think these are big questions ongoing. With same-sex marriage in particular, it seems less likely to me that the Supreme Court reverses itself on that question, but you're right that there's an ongoing discussion about really more focused on the downstream consequences of that particular decision. And so a lot of the discussions I hear about quite frequently are things like the cake baker and the florist, for the conservative Christian florist who doesn't want to do flowers for the gay wedding, and how does that come out under the law, or how should it come out under the law? Questions about possibly nonprofit status for different religious institutions. And those, I think, are ongoing and contested questions. And they're complicated by a number of details, including the extent that we're talking about the for-profit space, which echoes back to the civil rights era, whether and to what extent churches are involved, which might be seen differently under some understandings of the law. And then to me, one of the important and interesting questions is always, where is the real economic and social power in these situations? And so in a setting in which there is a monopoly of goods or services that is being stymied by a particular viewpoint or ideology to the exclusion of other people who need goods or services, that's a massively important problem. When there are market alternatives that are functioning well, then I think there might be greater room there, greater leeway for certain exemptions. But these are the kinds of questions, and they're very detailed questions. They're most likely going to unfold at the level of state law rather than federal law, and we're going to see them with us for a long time to come.
The movement that elected Donald Trump and his theme of making America great again, many people would think that, and this may be a stereotype, would say that those who wanted to make America great again were thinking in terms of going back to a time when the possibility of Sharia law coming to our shores would not even exist, back to a time when there wouldn't be a same-sex marriage, back to a time when the abortion was not legal, back to a time perhaps even before voting rights were in place, and even in recent years, the reversal of the voting rights legislation or the decisions that imposed or required certain efforts to encourage and extend voting rights to all citizens. I mean, is that part of the core of a movement that we're seeing right now, that there's a nostalgia for something that either did exist or that we think might have existed in the past?
Yeah, the nostalgia strand seems to be either implicit or explicit in a number of discussions. And I think you hinted at this in the question that you were asking, but it immediately requires the answer to what era would you like to return to and at what cost. And my dad is Japanese, and he was born in the internment camps during World War II. My grandparents were incarcerated for 4 years. And so I think, well, when I hear going back, I don't want to go back to the 1940s where I might have been imprisoned based on my race. And we can represent other people from other groups or demographics who could make compelling stories along those lines. And so this going back retrieval vision is only good if you go back to a time when your people were pretty well-to-do and in power. There's a related nostalgia question, though, that I think is at a deeper, more theoretically, but also more important level in some ways. And this is the idea that if we could only go back to a different policy approach to the world. And here I'm thinking of Yuval Levin's important book, The Fractured Republic, where Yuval says, really, in both major political strands, there's this nostalgia effort to go back to a different era and a different set of policies where things just seem to work better at a national level. And that's a different era for Democrats and Republicans. But both of those visions miss the present realities. We're just in a different world geopolitically, technologically, and otherwise. And so there's no plausible sense of going back. All it does, I think, is distort our perceptions of what we need to do in the current realities.
I mean, the subtitle of your book, Confident Pluralism, Surviving and Thriving Through Deep Difference, you obviously make a distinction between surviving and thriving. Talk a little bit about what you mean by that.
So I think that thriving, and sometimes I'm accused of a kind of naive optimism in this approach, but I actually do think that thriving is possible if we focus on what I take to be finding common ground, even when we don't agree on a common good, that we can find areas of agreement and things that we care about, and we can focus on forming real relationships across our differences. Now, that means we're not going to agree on everything, and the pain and the reality of our disagreements will limit, in some ways, our friendships. But that doesn't mean that we have to limit the possibility of relationships. And I think some of the best examples of relationships across difference are the ones that inspire us, the ones that lead us to unlikely conclusions. And that's where we see real thriving. We see the possibility of a performative way of life that encourages other people. We can see creative solutions to problems that seemed otherwise insurmountable. And we have these examples. We just don't spend a lot of time talking about them.
What do you mean by confident pluralism? I mean, pluralism obviously is going to exist. What is the opposite of confident pluralism?
Right, I get shy pluralism or something like
yes,
that, right?
Really.
So I think confidence in two ways. One, that if we are confident in our own beliefs and in the groups and institutions that sustain them, then that confidence ought to propel us to a greater willingness to engage across difference. We don't have a lot to lose. We don't have to worry about being challenged by different ideas, and we can enter into discussions and relationships with a more charitable position. And then secondly, we collectively, the people of this country, have to maintain a kind of confidence in the shared political experiment, in our laws, in our courts, in the narrative of this country. I don't actually think that has to be a very deep confidence. I'm not sure it's possible to make it very thick, but I do think we have to have some sort of minimally shared agreement about the importance of our laws, of our courts, of our nation's trajectory.
Are you confident about our shared political experience, about our experiment in this country? Does anything in recent years cause you to wonder about the confidence that you may have in it?
Yeah, I think it's fair to say that I wonder. I mean, some days more than others. I think increasingly that the near-term solutions have to unfold on the local level. I think it's hard to overstate the importance of real face-to-face relationships with neighbors who are going to be tied to common concerns based on practical needs, and the kinds of relationships that force us away from sound bites and tweets back and forth to discussions and running into each other in the store or on the street or sharing a school with our kids. And these are the kinds of things that forge a politics in a community that actually is more lived in some ways than the kinds of fake communities we forge online. I don't mean to say that all online communities are empty. There are certainly some great ones and some very meaningful ones, but so many of us move too much of our attention to these online existences that are not actually the fullness of our relationships.
I mean, you're on the campus of Eastern Kentucky University to keynote First Amendment Week. I guess we should talk a little bit about the First Amendment. Why is the First Amendment important to you, and what can we do to, I guess, bolster support, do a better job of living up to the First Amendment? Are there challenges to our ability to live within the ideal of the First Amendment?
Well, there are always going to be challenges, and part of those challenges remind us of the need to continue to tell each other the importance of why we have the First Amendment in the first place. There was a Pew study a few months ago that reported 40% of millennials favoring the ban of offensive speech under the law, which runs straight into sort of a core principle of the First Amendment, a hard-earned principle that arose from some important cases in the 1920s. And unless today's generation understands why we got to where we did on free speech principles, we're going to lose a shared sense of the importance of something like free speech. I come at the First Amendment. I wrote my first book on the right of assembly under the First Amendment, something that many people had not focused on for a number of years. And interestingly, assembly is the only right in the First Amendment that requires more than one person. You cannot assemble alone. You can do anything else, religion, press, speech alone, but you can't assemble alone. And so there's something, I think, to the idea in the First Amendment that there are parts of living that we have to do together, and the sets of values and norms that underlie the protection of our relationships and our groups, sometimes to the disagreement of majoritarian norms, and that's what underlies the First Amendment: this willingness to tolerate dissent and discomfort and sometimes instability.
How do we deal with the challenges to freedom of the press and its close connection to freedom of speech? The fact that there are those today who are more skeptical about believing what they read, more likely hear or see in media today. What can be done to reestablish some confidence in the Fourth Estate and the ability for our media to inform, educate, and better our society?
And this goes back, I think, to our earlier discussion about the importance of institutions and the fracturing of authority that's coming with the loss of institutions. And so it will be important to back people who are doing good work. You know, something as simply as subscribing to a paper where people are committed to journalistic integrity in the midst of a lot of noise, where there's, today with blogs and social media, it's hard to know even what the boundaries of the press are. But there are people who are trained professionals, and we still have schools of journalism that train people to take this seriously and do it well. That also means, I think, a more urgent responsibility on those who are professional journalists to do really good work, to, when they confront limitations or echo chambers, to do their very best to get out of them. And here I think, I look at something like the New York Times, and I think some of their reporting is excellent, and some of their editorializing is utterly partisan and reflects an echo chamber. And so the more that journalism can recover a sense of reporting and less editorializing, I think that there's more power in that in the long run. It's going to require resisting the urge to jump into the fray, and there's going to be a constant urge to jump into that fray.
John Inazu, as the keynote speaker for First Amendment Week as part of the Chautauqua Lecture Series, Confident Pluralism, Surviving and Thriving Through Deep Difference. What is the core of the message that you will have delivered? I'm going to figure out how to edit this to make it match up a few weeks after the fact. But what is the core of the message that you bring to the campus of Eastern Kentucky University and the folks who will come to hear you?
I think if there's going to be one major takeaway, it's that we are stuck, for better and for worse, with a lot of difference in this country, and we have to figure out a way to live with that difference. And that is going to require both changes to our laws and changes to our civic practices. And in the short term, we're the ones who are responsible for the ways that we relate to one another in our speech and the way we treat each other. And we've got to be doing a better job about that. That's within our power to change right now. And we could all stand to do a little more of it, to see each other more charitably, and ultimately to look collectively at the reasons that the law can help structure our relationships more effectively.
What can the 20-year-old college students who hear that talk do to live up to what you're hoping for?
Well, if you want a practical takeaway, spend a week off of social media and in front of other people and have conversations offline and ask yourselves, is there something better, different, or more helpful about having sustained conversations with real people that get me out of the online ways of discourse.
So what are your hopes for the American dream, and what are you looking for in the coming months, the coming years, in terms of achieving a confident pluralism in our society?
Well, I think in some ways the bar is so low right now that my hopes are pretty modest. I would like people to treat each other more kindly, to recognize that even though the stakes are sometimes very high, that we do find common ground with people with whom we disagree, and to look at the ordinary activities of life that can draw us more proximate to one another. And we've got a long way to go on this. And in some ways, the past months, politically and otherwise, have increased the sense of fraction and discontent that we feel with one another. So I want us to create the common space to learn better how to engage with one another, because we're stuck with each other, and this is going to be a long project together.
John Inazu, thank you for visiting the campus of Eastern Kentucky University, and thank you for spending some time with us on Eastern Standard.
John, it's been great to be with you. Thank you.
Eastern Standard is a production of the WEKU stations at Eastern Kentucky University, normally live on Thursday mornings. This week's program was recorded in advance. This program will also be available for online listening and downloading as a podcast from the website at weku.fm. Our associate producers for Eastern Standard are Devonna Gaines, Julia Dake, and Zach Redding. And we're interested in hearing from you with your comments, your suggestions, your ideas about future programs or topics. Write to us, WEKU Eastern Standard at gmail.com. Send a tweet at WEKUEST or leave a voicemail message, 859-622-1657. Thank you for tuning in. I'm John Hingsbergen for Eastern Standard and the WEKU stations.